Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, a jury continues to deliberate in the trial of former Utah State University football player Torrey Green, accused of sexually assaulting six women when he was a student. Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox says he doesn't expect a delay in the implementation of Medicaid expansion in the state, but lawmakers might have different plans. And later in the program, some grocery stores in Utah join the movement to increase the alcohol content of the beer found on their shelves. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry, and welcome to you, Dan.
Morning, Roger.
Also here in studio, editorial page editor George Pyle, and thanks for being here, George.
Good morning.
And then on the phone from Brigham City, we've got justice reporter Jessica Miller, and hello, Jessica, are you there?
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us. Listeners, you can join this conversation as well by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Jessica Miller, you have been covering the trial of former USU football player Torrey Green. That's why you are in Brigham City, where this trial is taking place. The news cycle is such that I think it's worth reminding people who he is and what he's accused of before we talk about the deliberations from the jury and how this trial played out. Can you remind us about this case and why Green was on trial?
Yeah, so Torrey Green was a football player at Utah State University, and during his time there, he was a student there from about 2012 to 2015. And over those years, there were several women who came forward, reported to police, reported to the university that that he had sexually assaulted these women. And so the Salt Lake Tribune in 2016 did a story highlighting four allegations of sexual assault involving Torrey that at that time had been, basically little had been done. Police didn't do a whole lot. The university didn't do a whole lot. Prosecutors didn't take the case on. And so after that happened, the prosecutors reexamined several of these cases. They brought charges against Green for seven of those cases. But today for this trial, these jurors have heard from six women who all give pretty similar accounts that they were sexually assaulted by Green. And so that's what they're deliberating today. He's charged with 11 felonies in connection with these six reports.
Okay, so there's six allegations being heard in this court case. There's, as you said, a seventh separate allegation. That will be heard in a separate case altogether, right, Jessica?
Yeah, so initially these cases were all filed individually, but the prosecutors had asked that since some of these cases were so similar, you know, the allegations were that, you know, he met these women on the first date, the first time he got them alone, he sexually assaulted them. It was in his apartment. He said similar things. The judge ruled that because those were so similar, they could testify in each other's trials. But then the defense team had asked if they could just consolidate it all to one case. But the seventh woman, her allegation is a little bit different. She says it was at a party. You know, it was a little bit different circumstance. But the judge ruled that that wasn't as similar. So that case is going to be tried separately.
Okay, well, let's turn to the trial itself. Actually, let's go to the closing arguments. They were held yesterday morning, and then the jury went into deliberations. And then I'm going to jump around here, Jessica. Actually, the jury came back and asked for more time. And so this is the second day that they're deliberating, right?
Yes, yeah, they deliberated for 8 hours yesterday, and then last night they asked if they could just come back today and keep deliberating. So they're back this morning. They probably are just getting underway right now.
So what are the similarities? You mentioned the similarities in the stories that these six women told about Green. What did they say? What were the accounts that they gave? And also, was Green present in the courtroom when they were testifying?
Yeah, he's been present throughout the trial. So all of these six women, they've all testified that they were assaulted during their first time alone with him. Five said that they were in his apartment. Several of them said that that Green took them into his bedroom to watch a movie before the assault, and several said that before or during the assault, he kind of made the same statements like, oh, like, you know, you'll like this and things like that. And so the prosecutors are kind of leaning on those similarities to say that, you know, these women don't know each other. They've never met each other. And yet they have these strikingly similar accounts. Like, how can someone be that unlucky to be falsely accused that many times? But On the other hand, Green actually did testify in the trial, and he told the jurors, you know, he didn't sexually assault anyone, that this could have been, he wished he could have treated women differently. He was into having casual sex at the time in college, and maybe he could have been more clear with these women about what his expectations were. They didn't want a long-term relationship. So that's kind of been his explanation so far, is that he did have sex with some of the women, but it was consensual.
Right. He said, "I wish I didn't break their hearts," was one quote from your article on this.
Yeah, that's what he said. He said he wished that he didn't break their hearts, and that he could have done a better job of letting them know that he didn't want to be in a long-term relationship, implying that these women were upset with him because, you know, they didn't get a second date, or they went, maybe had gone to a party afterwards and seen him with another woman, and that this could be stemming from either jealousy, or there's also some talk about, you know, the media coverage with the Salt Lake Tribune story coming out, and maybe women might have come forward after that because they wanted attention or something of that nature.
And that's an argument that his defense attorney made in closing arguments as well. This is Sky Lazaro. What did she say in that closing argument?
So one of these cases that the jury is considering right now, the prosecutors did screen the case at the time and declined to file charges on that case. And so she kind of made the argument that, you know, that case wasn't good enough several years ago when the prosecutors looked at this case. And it's still not good enough now. And she basically equated this whole trial to the prosecutors bending to media pressure, that, you know, this Tribune article came out, it's pretty critical of the prosecutors and the police and the university. And so this was the reaction that they had to kind of counteract the negative media attention that they received.
Mm. Will you remind us quickly, Jessica, why this trial is taking place in Brigham City instead of in Logan, where these assaults allegedly occurred?
Yeah, so the defense team had asked for a change of venue because they were concerned that, you know, Logan's such a small town and it's so connected to Utah State University. There was a concern that maybe he wouldn't get a fair trial there just because of how interconnected the university is with the community there. And also there was some discussion, he's a black man, and all of the alleged victims in this case are white women. And, you know, maybe that could play into not being able to seat a fair jury, that they might be prejudiced against him. So the judge ruled that specifically with the interconnectivity between the university and the community there, that it would be best to move the trial to Brigham City. So that's why it's being tried here.
You know, we talked about what the defense said in its closing arguments and what Sky Lazaro said, but then I guess in closing arguments for the prosecutor, this is Deputy Cache County Attorney Spencer Walsh. How did he try to bring this case home? You mentioned the similarities in the accounts of the women.
He called Green throughout this whole trial. The prosecutor says basically tried to like hammer to the jury that Green was a wolf in sheep's clothing, that on the surface he was this very charming person. He was good looking. You know, he had this way with women. He was able to use his charm to basically disarm them, make them trust him, to bring him into his apartment and then sexually assault him. So they're kind of casting him as this like serial predator who uses the same tactics over and over again to get women alone to then assault them.
I want to bring George Pyler, for that matter, Dan Harrion on this. We are one of the things that we're hearing from the defense attorney in this is reporting, you know, calling out sort of reporting from the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm just wondering how often we hear the Tribune or other newspapers being called out in court cases like this. It's probably not all that uncommon. I don't know. Can you guys answer that question?
Well, I would say that one of the common defense tactic is to blame media coverage for prejudicing or exaggerating evidence that the defense is trying to argue against. You know, it's one of the reasons that they vet juries for what sources of media they get their news from.
Yeah, I've covered, it's been a long time, but I've covered a few felony trials a long time ago, and they would say when they were questioning potential jurors, you know, do you know anything? Do you know the defendant? Do you know the alleged victim? Do you know the attorneys? Have you have any personal or business relationships with any of these people that might make you less than totally unbiased in approaching this? And what do you know about the case? What have you read about the case? What have you heard on the street? What have you read in the paper? And what was kind of frustrating for a young reporter in those days was you'd written like 8 stories about this case, and all the potential jurors say, no, never heard about it at all. I have no idea what you're talking about. And it's like, don't you guys read the paper? But those are perfect jurors, people who never read the paper.
I think in this case, too, you know, the Tribune was so far leading the coverage that basically without its coverage, they really wouldn't have reinvestigated these cases. And I think that's why it's coming up in the trial.
Yeah, I think that's probably, I mean, whether he's guilty or not, the statement that the state, the prosecutors, the police had sort of let all this go until the Tribune brought it to public attention, I think that's, I hope no jurors are listening right now, I think that's probably true. Now, that doesn't mean that he did or did not do these things, that he did or that the relationship was or was not consensual. But, yeah, the fact that the press brought this up and said, hey, what about this? Why aren't you following this? Why did he get special treatment because he was a football player? Do you just not care about anybody? And this is also at the same time the Tribune – the news staff, not me, was doing all the work they did about the women who had been victims of sexual assault down at BYU.
Right.
And not only had their cases not been taken seriously, they were actually punished by the university for these honor code violations, for being somewhere they weren't supposed to be or drinking when they weren't supposed to. And that gets used as a weapon by people who have committed sexual assault or just, you know, preyed on women, even if it wasn't a crime, to say...
to prevent reporting.
So yeah. You can't report this because you'll get in more trouble than I will.
Hey, Jessica, from your reporting on this, George mentioned the sort of potential professional football career of Torrey Greene. From your reporting, I gather that the only time, or the one time in particular when he showed emotion during this trial was when he talked about the career that he had lost after these allegations came to light. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so he testified for most of the day earlier this week, and you know, throughout his testimony, he was very calm and kind of recounting each encounter with each of these women, kind of giving his side of the story. And even on cross examination, you know, there's really hard questions asked of him. Did you rape this woman? Did you do this? You know, and he was pretty calm. No, I did not. No, I'm not a rapist. But the only time he really became emotional was when his attorney asked him about what his dreams were, you know, what he wanted to do. And obviously he wanted to be in the NFL. He had been drafted, but was cut after these allegations came to light. But also he's from a place in California where it's apparently a pretty rough neighborhood. The saying there is nothing good comes out of Robideau. And so he was hoping to kind of be that person that kids in his community could look up to as an example. And that, you know, hasn't happened for him.
Hmm. Jessica, I mean, the jury is going to come back with a verdict on this at some point, I guess, unless they don't. But
hopefully today. Yeah.
Yeah, you're watching this. You're there in Brigham City watching this unfold today. I know that we need to let you go here in just a minute, but thank you for your reporting on this. And maybe you can call us back if you get a verdict anytime soon and
right.
break some news on the show. But thank
right.
you again.
Yeah, that'd be perfect.
Thank you again for your reporting on this. And I'll just point listeners to sltrib.com, where you can find Jessica Miller's great reporting on this and a great many other topics. We need to take our first break in the show. But again, Jessica, thanks for joining us. You're listening to Behind the
Thank
Headlines.
You.
You're welcome. Here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
This week on the Putumayo World Music Hour,
we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday with songs from around the world about the fight for freedom and equality.
Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom?
I and I people must live on.
I'm Rosalie Howard.
And I'm Dan Storper.
Pack your bags and celebrate with us on the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
What do ancient myths have to do with today? In the age of Me Too, plenty.
I would be working and then I would go check the news, and it would be literally about what I had just been writing about. I have always felt very passionately that these myths are relevant, but it really drove the point home.
From Homer to Harvey Weinstein, reclaiming women's power on the next To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRX.
Sunday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry and editorial page editor George Pyle. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. You can also post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Dan Harry, the state of Utah, the legislature in particular, has not been a fan of full Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. And so for years, we've not taken it. We've tried to find other ways to get more limited coverage to low-income Utahns in the state. This year, though, there was a citizen initiative to make taking full Medicaid expansion the law, and it passed. However, because the medical marijuana ballot initiative that passed was rolled back and to a certain extent replaced in a special session of the legislature, we've been expecting something similar to happen to Medicaid expansion during the upcoming regular session. So it came as kind of a surprise this week when a state official said that he expected Medicaid expansion to happen after all. Why does he expect that, and who are we talking about, Dan?
Well, we're talking about Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, and what he said was that he doesn't expect a delay in the implementation. So under the initiative that was passed, the Medicaid expansion would happen on April 1st. And this other alternative that if the legislature replaced it, it would again ask the federal government for a waiver from its normal rules to have things like work requirements and to have the coverage of just people under 100% of the poverty level. So they would have to get a federal waiver for the differences from the Affordable Care Act Medicaid expansion. And that would, I mean, they've been trying to do that for months and months and months, and there has been no waiver. So really, you know, what is the belief that this would happen anytime soon under a new plan? So the governor, Lieutenant Governor, was saying, no, this, we believe this is going to move forward on time. Now, what does that mean exactly? We don't know. The legislature is still talking about a replacement bill.
Right.
And they're even talking about like a bridge that they would have the full Medicaid expansion, but a partial one take place on April 1st. And then they would seek the waiver, but they would cover far fewer people under that proposal.
Under the bridge or under the this is Alan Christensen's proposal of North Ogden, and his would cover about 70,000 low-income Utahns. Again, it would have a work requirement. You're talking about the bridge, though.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, what they're talking about now probably would cover about 100,000 people versus 150,000 low-income, and it would be more costly because you know, you wouldn't get the full 90-10 split that the federal government would pay 90% under the Affordable Care Act. You'd get 70%. So it would be more costly for the state. The concern of legislators that they're expressing is that they think this is a budget buster down the road, and they don't want to make a commitment to give people insurance and then pull it back because, really, if you've looked at the history, it's very hard to pull back insurance benefits and social programs like that once you implement them. So that's what they're afraid of.
And Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox also said that he doubts that the tax increase set up in Prop 3, which led to – which was the initiative on Medicaid expansion, that tax increase would actually pay for the full expansion. He doesn't think it's – as like legislators, he doesn't think that
right. There's some skepticism there that down the road – that it would not cover the full cost.
We talked about this pretty extensively on the show last week. I'm just wondering, I'm looking at the quote from Spencer Cox says that both he and the governor, Governor Gary Herbert, are moving forward with the expectation that Medicaid expansion will happen under the timeline set out by this ballot initiative. But we have, you know, so that would require some sort of alternative plan if we don't just accept that Medicaid expansion.
Now, you mentioned Prop 2, which was the medical marijuana. There's a big difference in the way, so far anyway, this is shaping up. In that case, people who were behind the proposition actually negotiated with legislators and others to come up with this replacement bill. So there were a lot of people still unhappy that it was replaced by the legislature, but the ones who had organized the initiative were on board with it. And it was, you know, they negotiated. The bills were released publicly before the session started. And so this one, there is no participation by the sponsors of the initiative. They're adamantly opposed to the legislature coming in and replacing it. There is no buy-in on this as there was in the Prop 2 case. So, you know, it's a very different scenario. And I expect that those who did organize and get this initiative passed will fight it tooth and nail. Hmm.
George Pyle, editorial voice there at the Salt Lake Tribune and are on the show today. You know, right, you have the Affordable Care Act, you know, which was previously known as Obamacare, mm-hmm. or is known commonly, I guess, as Obamacare, yeah. which led a number of states to take this full Medicaid expansion. Utah delayed. Utah said, you know, we don't want to buy into it. One thing that I wonder, and maybe this is actually a question for you, Dan, is the Governor Gary Herbert, originally could have just accepted full Medicaid expansion at any time, right? Can he still, if he wants to see it implemented, do that? I mean, I doubt that from a political standpoint that would make sense.
I guess technically he can do it, but he hasn't shown any inclination to do that. Although he also has said that he is not going to run for re-election, so... There's that.
George Pyle, in terms of just Medicaid expansion with a work, you know, requirement mm-hmm. that is kind of the alternative proposal here and that would cover less people versus the larger expansion that would cost more from the state's perspective.
No.
Well, or would it,
well, yeah, they would. Yeah. It would cost more state money to cover fewer people. And this has been all the alternatives that have been brought along the whole way. They want to spend more state money to cover fewer people. And it just doesn't – I mean, this is the opinion editor talking now. It makes no sense at all. It's churlish. It's cruel. It's a deliberate attempt to punish poor people for being poor. There is no reason not to just take Medicaid expansion under the ACA, provide this coverage to the people who are in the gap and don't make enough money to qualify for the subsidies on healthcare.com or .gov. But they do, and other states have expressed the same problem, and it has in some states cost more than they thought it was going to cost. Because come to find out, I mean, there are a lot of people who were eligible for Medicaid before who weren't taking it. Just they didn't bother to sign up, or you couldn't find them, or they didn't realize there was such a thing, or they move in and out of employment, or they move around, they don't have a permanent address. And so they were eligible before, but they weren't on the program. Now with this, then there's a lot more publicity, and you think a lot more people would be saying, oh, you're eligible for Medicaid, let's get you signed up. And so there will be more people maybe than they think. Now, the people who proposed it, they say they did the math. They figured out how many people would probably come on the plan and then added a little more just to be safe. And then they figured out how much that would cost and added a little more just to be safe. And this is how much money will be raised by this added sales tax. So I mean, some states, they just said, whether it was the initiative of the governor, the initiative of the legislature, the initiative of the electorate, they just said, okay, we'll take it and we'll figure out how to pay for it later. And it has kind of been a pain in the neck. Here, at least, the attempt is, not only do we want to have this program, we want to pay for it. We are willing to tax ourselves, we the people, this extra 0.15, I forget what it is. It's a very small addition to the sales tax rate for non-food items to pay for it.
Yeah, and some states have seen sort of an economic boon as a result of taking Medicaid expansion from reporting that I've seen, and I'm sorry I can't give you a citation right now. But why do lawmakers, and this is a question for Dan Harry, why do lawmakers say that the way that Prop 3 was designed doesn't pay enough to capture that 90-10 split? I mean, what are they citing there?
Well, you know, it's all estimates, right? You don't know how much something's going to cost down the road. You don't know how many people are going to enroll. You don't know what the cost of the program is going to be until it's implemented. So they're all estimates. So the folks who push the initiative, their estimates are that the tax increase that they've coupled with the initiative will cover the costs, and the legislative fiscal analysts don't agree with that. They have different estimates. Who's right? I couldn't tell you.
And so, I mean, we've got T-minus 11 days until the start of this year's meeting of lawmakers, and you know, I'm sure we'll get a clearer picture of what the state wants to do and will end up doing as the legislature proceeds, but until then, we don't know. I mean, this would be the second of three ballot initiatives that the legislature would alter.
Well, there's talk of altering, right? We don't know that this is going to happen.
Yeah. Well, and the lieutenant governor was the one out the other day saying he doesn't think it's going to be altered, or at least it's not going to be delayed. And as he should, the administration, the initiative passed. It hasn't yet been altered. They're duty bound to fill out the paperwork and do all the stuff and get it ready to go. I think it's interesting to note that in addition to being lieutenant governor and potential candidate for governor and in charge of all the elections, Spencer Cox is the point man on the state efforts to help with the homeless problem. And full Medicaid expansion is the closest you've got to a silver bullet to help with the homeless problem. And if you're walking around in Utah saying, I want to help the homeless, and you are not for full Medicaid expansion, this is the opinion guy again, you are lying. Mm-hmm. That is a lie to say, I care about the homeless, but I don't want to take full Medicaid expansion, because you don't really care about the homeless if you don't want to take full Medicaid expansion.
Dan Harry, this is the also kind of the context where Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox was making his statements about Medicaid expansion was at a meeting of the Pioneer Park Coalition.
Right.
And in the context of Operation Rio Grande, which was a homelessness initiative in the Pioneer Park area. You know, is he trying to influence what the legislature might do by making comments like this? Who knows?
Well, I would think so. You know, I would think that it's maybe not a shot across the bow, but it is sort of laying down a marker saying, look, you know, the governor and I are going to support this going into effect on April 1 as it was proposed. Our agencies are preparing for it. They're getting ready to implement it, and we fully expect that. So, yeah, I definitely think that's a message to the legislature.
We've got we should probably turn to some other stories here, but we've actually got a caller on the line from Salt Lake City who is commenting on the story that we were covering earlier in the show when Jessica Miller was on the line, and this is the trial of Tory Greene in Brigham City. And Julie, what's your comment?
My comment is every time I have read about Tory Greene or just now listening to you commenting about Tory Greene's trial, there's always this description of Tory Greene as a talented athlete and an NFL potential, and implying he has dreams and he has potential, and what a tragedy that would be if he loses that. I'm not guessing whether he's guilty or innocent, but I wonder why always the person being tried, if it's a male, gets we need to know what their potential is and what they would lose. I never hear that same thing happen when we're talking about the victims.
That's a really interesting, that's a very interesting.
We never say these six women have potential and they have dreams and maybe they're traumatized and maybe this will ruin their lives. But we never hear about their potential. It's always the tragic potential of the perpetrator, if it's a male. And this happens all the time.
And you see it in the media, I mean, frequently, and I think I'm guilty of it myself, just as you said, Julie, having said it earlier in the show. It's an interesting point. Let me turn to our panelists here and see what they have to say about it as well.
I'll just say, Julie, that I hope you read the coverage of the Salt Lake Tribune. Those stories mostly were telling the stories of the women who were victimized here. That's what the focus entirely was. It really was not much about Tory Greene as it was what these women went through. So, I mean, that gets lost, I think, in some of the shorthand, but I think those stories are being told.
And I did see that. But earlier, a day earlier than that, there's this descriptor before his name or after his name, Tory Greene, talented athlete with NFL potential. And I think that biases things.
Well, I think, it could bias it one way, it could bias it the other way. And when you're telling the story, you've got to say who this person is. You can't tell the whole story without saying, I mean, is he a talented football player? Is he a guy who is going to be working in the cafeteria for the rest of his life? Whichever it is, you tell people that. And
well,
also,
but
I think
I never see those descriptors for women.
Well, in a lot of cases, we don't tell you who the women are. In many cases, that's been part of the reporting now, is we do tell you who the women are. We do tell you their stories. Traditionally, in the media, though, victims of sexual assault are not even named, much less have their life story out there. And that's just been tradition because we think we're
quite frequently, women are described as, what were they doing going somewhere alone, and what were they doing that, that might have caused this? That happens a lot.
Julie, and thank you very much for your call on this. We've even had callers into the show who have expressed the sentiments that you just did, but very earnestly, which is, it's always interesting. There's a sense of victim blaming happening, and thank you again for your call.
Yeah, that's always an issue.
It's just a pattern that I see.
Yeah, okay. It's always an issue. I think also my concern about naming him as a football player and everything is I really think you have to consider whether that was a reason why these charges were not followed up, whether there really was a crime committed, whether he really is guilty of a crime or not.
Right.
The allegations were made, and you really have to stop and think. Allegations were made. They were not followed up, rightly or wrongly.
Here's a star
is the fact that he's a star football player a reason why the allegations were not followed up? And
true.
At first, there were stories about saying a student at Utah State University was named in these. We didn't name the student either. Then after a while, we did, and we said he was a football player. And I'm going, okay, show of hands, who is surprised that a person accused of sexual assault, not charged, not even investigated, who is surprised that that's an athlete, that that happened?
Well, and look at the NFL. I mean, the culture there is we see tremendous abuse and sexual assault cases brought against these star football players, and sometimes with very little consequence.
Right.
I mean, they have a culture there that there's something definitely wrong.
So the fact that the NFL dumped this person after a charge hasn't even been convicted yet is relevant, is newsworthy.
Julie, thank you so much for calling in with your comment, and I appreciate the sentiment as well. And we're going to move on to some other stories from this past week's news, but thanks for calling
and
for listening.
Thanks for taking my call.
Of course. Interesting comments. We always appreciate the calls from listeners. The number to call is 801-355-8255 if you want to join this conversation, or you can post them at sltrip.com. We don't have a lot of time left in the show before we turn to a feature featuring Kathy Stevenson, food and alcohol reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. But Dan Harry, I wanted to talk about a story that took place having to do with Legacy Parkway.
Yeah.
And there was a community meeting in North Salt Lake this week at the Foxborough Elementary School. And it was a chance for residents there to vent to their lawmakers and to other state officials about something that snuck up on them. And it's kind of an odd story made new again because of a tiny piece of text in state code. It has to do with this Legacy Parkway. Why was this meeting happening, Dan?
Well, if you've ever traveled Legacy Parkway, it's kind of an enjoyable experience and very different than going on I-15. You've got two lanes in each direction. You have a lowered speed limit, 55, although people don't always follow that. And you have no billboards. You have no big trucks, semis on the pavement, and you've got some wide open spaces where you can look out toward the Great Salt Lake, and it's just a very calming kind of peaceful experience. And that's because environmentalists had sued the state over the original Legacy plan, and they'd gotten these concessions from the state: the ban on trucks, the lowered speed limit, special pavement that quiets the noises there, no billboards, all of the two lanes, all of those were concessions made to environmentalists. What most people didn't know, including me, who'd overseen a lot of the coverage of Legacy, was that it was only lasting 15 years. And now that goes away unless the legislature acts to change it. Now, knowing the legislature and how they often are doing the work of business. They believe in business in the Utah legislature, which is fine. But, you know, the trucking industry really wants back on that road. And highway builders really want to see increased lanes on that road. And others want the speed limit raised, especially trucks. They don't want to be slowed down. So there are a lot of these forces that are going to be coming up in the legislature. If the legislature doesn't act, all those things will be lifted. So the neighbors and members of the community who live nearby are very concerned that those attributes are all going to go away.
So they want to see those attributes preserved, and that could be done. They want to see the ban on trucks extended. They want to see the speed limits stay the same. They want to see the same kind of pavement, which is quiet pavement, et cetera.
And no expansion of lanes.
And no expansion of lanes. And Senator Todd Weiler, who is the senator for this area, is going to try and extend that
The truck ban.
Those conditions, the truck ban. This is during the legislative session. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Dan, I was actually at this meeting as part of a kind of longer-term reporting project, and I was struck by something that Senator Todd Weiler said, which was that his two-year extension, this is what he's proposing, is to extend the ban by 2 years because he doesn't believe that he could do it permanently, that would not pass the legislature. And he's not even certain that the two-year ban can pass. But that two-year extension would give residents breathing room to decide whether they wanted to stay there or if they wanted to sell their homes.
Well, you know, I don't know about that argument. If somebody doesn't want to stay there, they have to sell it. And what are the selling points to somebody? You would probably have to disclose the fact that, you know, these attributes that make that a nice, peaceful community are going to change.
Property value is another concern for residents there. I mean, a lot of residents bought homes in the area, and they had no idea that this truck ban would be lifted at some point, or that the speed limit might go up, or the quiet, rubberized road might go away, and so on. I don't know. Is a permanent ban really that impossible for the legislature?
I really have no idea. You know, maybe this will be the subject of another initiative. You know, it seems like more and more, as we've seen this last year, when the legislature won't budge on something, people decide that they need to take it into their own hands and get an initiative. But also, we've seen this movement by the legislature to push back and change initiatives that are passed.
Is Legacy Parkway, I mean, if it becomes a highway again, or becomes a highway, not again, it was never a highway, is that seen as a way for trucks to access the planned inland port?
Yeah, that's one of the arguments that's brought up, absolutely. And they're also right now in the planning stages of a northward extension of Legacy. And right now, there is no plan for that to have a truck ban or a lowered speed limit. So, you know, that's what the future looks like.
George Pyle, quick comments, because we do need to turn to a break and then come back with our underplayed stories of the week. But quick comments on the expiring of this truck ban on Legacy Parkway and the changes to those attributes.
Yeah, see, I was, like a lot of people, I wasn't aware that was temporary. That was part of the deal. I mean, a lot of people thought there shouldn't be a Legacy Parkway at all, and they had to fight with the Corps of Engineers and do all kinds of wetland reclamation and everything else. And this was the deal. Okay, we'll build this because cars need to drive there, but we'll do all these other things to kind of mitigate it for the surrounding area. Now they tell them, well, just for a while. And, you know, regardless of the legality of it, that's not a way to be concerned about your constituents.
Well, it's a weird way to build anything, right? You know, we're going to build it for 15 years, spend a lot of money, and then 15 years later undo it. But that's where we are right now.
Well, it's kind of the symptom. I mean, every place you go that has interstate highways, you build it, people drive on it, more people drive on it, so you have to make it bigger. So more people drive on it, so you have to make it bigger.
Which came first?
And it just keeps happening, and pretty soon you're out of room.
All right. Well, you know, we're going to keep following the story definitely as the legislature unfolds. Right now, we need to head to another break in the show. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We will be right back.
Many of us are still processing the Kavanaugh hearings and the 2018 elections. We're absorbing the news and wondering where the Me Too movement is and where it's going. As a part of the UPR original series, Utah Women 2020, Utah Public Radio is hosting a town hall panel discussion titled Me Too Continues, Where Are We Post-Kavanaugh Post-Election? Join us Friday, January 25th at 6 p.m. in the Lundstrom Student Center on the USU campus. Come with your questions and comments and join the discussion. Details at upr.org.
Hi, I'm Steve Williams, host of Jazz Time here on Utah Public Radio. I hope you'll join me Sunday evenings for a journey through the world of jazz music, from ragtime to bop, from Havana to Logan, Utah. Tune in for a bit of history, commentary, the occasional interview, and of course, all that jazz. Jazz Time, Sunday evenings at 6 o'clock on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry and George Pyle. This is our Friday morning news roundup. And to save time for a recorded conversation with food and alcohol reporter Kathy Stevenson, we need to turn now to our picks for underplayed story of the week. And Dan Harry, do you care to get the ball rolling?
You bet. I don't know if it was underplayed, but it was a great story. It was by Taylor Stevens the other day. It was about Allen Park, which is nicknamed by some Hobbitville. It's in Sugar House across the 13th East from Westminster. And if you've never been there, it's a wonderful kind of little private community with very esoteric structures and bridges across the stream there and stairways leading up to housing. And there used to be a lot of birds there, right, and trees. And just an amazing little place. And, you know, it used to be that high school kids and others would go through there and you know, as high school kids do, make up stories about who lived there and how it came to be. But Hobbit the place land is going bankrupt, and they're kicking everybody out. And so Taylor Stevens talked to one of the last residents that was packing up her stuff the other day. And it's just a great story. If you haven't read it, go to sltrib.com and take a look at that.
Yeah, it's kind of an iconic place in Salt Lake City. Yeah. Check that out. George Pyle, have you got a pick for underplayed story of the week?
Well, generally, I mean, I don't know how you can possibly underplay the federal shutdown, but the Tribune has had a lot of good stories about how people are dealing with it, people being called back to work without pay, free admission to the Hogle Zoo for federal employees who are on unpaid furlough. And this morning, Brian Mathley had a story about 50 seasonal employees of the U.S. Forest Service whose job it is to go up in the mountains and prevent or detect avalanches are continuing to go to work with no pay because this is such an important job. And I think it kind of comes to the point of, you know, we think, oh, the federal government just taxes us. Federal government just, you know, runs the army. The federal government does a lot of stuff,
right,
most of it to serve people. And a lot of it now is either not being done or being done by people who are basically volunteering their time. And, you know, this is what happens when Congress can't get its act together.
Well, and this group is volunteering their time to try and save lives, which
right
is an interesting
point. They're not going to walk away from this job just because they're not getting paid. It's too important.
All right. Great pick for underplayed story of the week by George Pyle. I'm going to go with a no-driver shuttle coming to you, a driverless shuttle, kind of as an experiment that UTA is looking at as a potential last mile, you know, between your home and the bus stop or your home and the track station and vice versa. A driverless vehicle experiment that's coming to Utah. Check that out at sltrip.com. Mm-hmm. Dan Harry and George Pyle, both of you with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining us on Behind the Headlines.
Thanks, Roger.
Thank you.
We're going to wrap up today with a conversation featuring Salt Lake Tribune food and alcohol reporter Kathy Stevenson, who told me about the diminished availability of six-packs of beer at your local grocery store. Kathy Stevenson, Utah, in its grocery stores, sells 3.2% beer. The listeners can't see that I'm doing air quotes, but I am making them because some people question whether or not it's actually beer. But that's neither here nor there. Our state is kind of a rarity. We're just one of two states, is that right, that have beer that is sold at this alcohol level in the grocery stores?
We were one of five.
Okay.
But soon we will be only one of two because the amount of 3.2 beer, the states that allow 3.2 beer in their grocery stores or require it, they're going away.
They're allowing higher percentage alcohol to be sold in their beer to be sold.
Oklahoma.
Okay.
And Oklahoma, their law changed in October. Colorado's changed January 1st. And then coming July 1st, Kansas.
Okay.
They're all going to allow higher alcohol beer in the grocery store. So that leaves pretty much Utah. Minnesota does too, but Minnesota has private liquor stores. So it's not really the same thing. So Utah really will be the only one.
Well, and we were warned, I mean, this is a couple of years ago, that there might be repercussions for our state here for consumers in the state of Utah. And those warnings are kind of coming true. Can you talk about the warnings and what we're reaping right now?
Yeah. So we've known about it for a couple of years. They've been saying this is going to happen. This is going to happen. And we are seeing it. It's not really that they're not making 3-2 beer anymore. They're just not making it as often, and they're packaging it different. So we are not seeing the packaging that we used to see, and it's really showing up in the number of six-packs.
Six-packs, the sort of denominator, I mean, the thing you think of as beer. So what's happening to our six-packs?
Not as many in some of the kind of major brands that you would think. You can still get some, but, you know, Bud Light... I should say Bud Light Platinum,
okay.
Corona, Landshark, Michelob, Amber Bock, Miller High Life. I mean, there's 13 that kind of a lobbying group has identified as not being available as much as it has been in the past.
I'm looking at the list, and Budweiser is on, just Budweiser.
Budweiser, cans and bottles.
I mean, you can't get a six-pack of Budweiser at the grocery store. Is this not America, Kathy?
I know. What's happening? You know, stop at the grocery store and pick up a six-pack. What is that?
So, you hinted to the fact that there's a lobbying group. There's a movement afoot to change the law here so that we do what those other states did and allow higher percentage alcohol beer to be sold in grocery stores. Who's behind that movement?
It's the manufacturers, the distributors, the wholesalers, brewers as well. They've kind of pulled their money and hired a lobbyist. Her name is Kate Bradshaw, and she is director of the Responsible Beer Choice Coalition.
Some grocery stores are getting behind the movement and actually encouraging their customers to sign on to this movement, sort of.
Smith's just started rolling out their little ads. You can see them in the beer aisle. They say text, you know, a number, text beer to this number, and you can learn how to put your name on a petition, learn how to kind of help the campaign. Walmart started doing it about a month ago. So two big retailers have kind of stepped up and are pushing it with their consumers.
Is the legislature interested in, I mean, this is a hard question for you to answer, but is this something that, are there any bills in the works, for example, where we might see this happening? Do we know?
I reached out to Senator Jerry Stevenson from the story that I published, and he did not call me back.
Okay.
That's not really unusual. The legislature hasn't even started yet.
Right.
So they usually like to keep alcohol bills in their back pocket and get consensus before they really introduce those. So I think there might be a bill. I think they will have to address it, but so far, no.
You know, in your
is that
story,
vague enough for you?
That is we won't know until we know is essentially the answer. And that's the way it is with so much lawmaking. But Kathy, in your article, there was one thing that was kind of surprising, or maybe surprising to readers, which was that Utah brewers, people who are here making beer in the state of Utah, aren't necessarily, or they don't really want to see the increase in that percentage. Why?
No, they're saying this Responsible Beer Choice Coalition is really funded by the mega brewers, you know, the Bud Lights and the Budweisers and the MillerCoors, and it benefits them. It does not benefit the small brewer. The small brewers say this group wants to just bump it up a little bit. We would still be the lowest in the nation. We bump from 3.2 to 4.8%. You know, why just a little bump? Why aren't we discussing maybe a bigger bump? And why can't the local brewers fill the void? Okay, so six packs of these other beers aren't available, but hey, there's great beer being made in Utah. Why can't we fill the void?
Right.
So I think they're, you know, they have talked to the coalition, but they're really saying, hey, they're spending a lot of money to benefit the big boys, and it's not really best for Utah economy and Utah business.
Okay. Hey, you mentioned the 3.2 to 4.8% alcohol by weight.
By weight.
Which is a jump from 4 to 6 by volume, roughly.
By volume, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the standard that everybody else uses in the country, 4% to 6%, which I think is easier to read and understand, right?
Right. It's just whole numbers.
Whole numbers.
But so what does that actually mean? Like when we talk about that jump from 4 to 6%, what, you know, for each can of beer, each bottle, what does that mean?
It would be a half of a tablespoon more of alcohol per container, can or bottle.
If you actually went that full range.
If you went that full range. Not every beer is going to do that. You know, you might go from 3.2 to, you know, 4.3 or something. So you're talking teaspoons, really. You know?
Yeah.
So it's not that much. That's what the coalition's saying. Like, it, you know, if you put it in terms that people can understand, it's really not that much.
Well, it's fascinating. And, you know, the idea that we're talking about raising the alcohol content of anything, I mean, is this not Utah, Kathy? No, I'm sorry. I had to make the same joke.
And that is the point of the coalition. We are in Utah, and we know that the majority of people don't want to promote consumption of alcohol. They don't mind that you have it, but they're not going to make it, you know, a free-for-all. And so they're saying that's why we're willing to just go the small percentage to restore what we've lost and not go like the local brewers say, let's go higher. Why not have no cap at all in the grocery store? Why not pull all the beer out of the liquor stores and make it available? And the coalition saying, you know, this is Utah. That might not fly with lawmakers or the public.
And maybe especially because of the fact that we now have a new 0.05 blood alcohol level limit in the state, which is the lowest in the nation.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, we are conservative and we make alcohol available, but, you know, they're tough on drunk driving, underage drinking. Those are the focus. And right or wrong, that's what our state, you know, is about. And so why try to push something that probably won't pass in the legislature? Why do an unlimited cap when that's probably not going to go? So that's why that coalition is saying, you know, let's just take the step, restore it to the minimum level and restore these six packs that are available in other states and make them bring them back here.
Maybe they can craft a compromise where we bring back the Zion curtain and at the same time increase the alcohol content for beer in grocery stores.
I do find it interesting, though, that when you're taking away the six packs, so if you really like that certain beer, you're still going to buy it. So now you're buying 12 packs. So in a way, the legislature, by not addressing it sooner, has forced people to buy more beer.
Well, Kathy Stevenson, food and booze reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for coming in and telling us about what may or may not happen in Utah's grocery stores.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. And that's Kathy Stevenson from the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find her reporting on food, alcohol, and more at sltrib.com. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW and the team up at Utah Public Radio in Logan for their help. You can find podcasts at kcpw.org or however you get your podcasts. Should you be interested, you can always catch up with KCPW on Facebook at KCPW88.3. On Twitter, we are at KCPW. And on Twitter, I'm at Roger McDonough. Thanks for joining us today. Have a great weekend, and we will see you again next Friday.
For the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend, we'll hear jazz, old and new, as liberation music, the power of soul, protest songs, and sacred music search for both standing firm and peace in the valley. Also, New Orleans percussionist Cyril Neville speaks of social justice. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Tomorrow night at 8 on Utah Public Radio. Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members, and Cash Arts presents the national tour of Rodgers and Hammerstein's The King and I, based on the Lincoln Center Theater production and featuring classic songs like Shall We Dance and Getting to Know You, January 22nd and 23rd at 7:30 p.m. Ticket information at casharts.org.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, and also heard at upr.org.